Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens, at the heart of Irish homes for over 40 years. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Have you noticed that resignations are kind of in the ether? There's been a rash of high-profile ones in the last week alone. Gareth Southgate as England manager, Leo Varadkar from politics, Mickey Hart as Derry manager, Gabrielle Attal as French Prime Minister, and the Welsh First Minister and most of his cabinet all resigning as well. All of whom are presumably going to do something else with their lives, and some of whom will find that transition bumpier than others. So how do you make the ride into your second act or off into the sunset as smooth as possible? I'm joined by Peter Cosgrove, Managing Director of FutureWise, and Sinead Brady, career psychologist and the author of Total Reset. Good morning to both of you.
Peter, good morning, Philip.
Why are most people that you're talking to leaving their jobs? Is it to do with salary or is it something else?
No, it's very rarely salary. I know people always think it is. That's the excuse people give. But the reality is anyone who wants a salary bump, can, especially in today's market, could probably leave today and always get 5 or 10% because there's always that thing of jeopardy of moving jobs.
Okay, so what is it?
Most people are doing it because of a manager or because the job is either too challenging or more likely not challenging enough. So actually they're going into work every day, either dreading the relationships they're having with their colleagues or their boss, or actually the job itself. And that feeling of kind of dread over a number of months or a period of time makes people move jobs. And then often they say it's because of salary, okay, but it's rarely the case.
Listen up, bosses. Be nice to your employees. Do you get the same feeling, Sinead?
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more with Peter. And so people are, on the one instance, as Peter said, suffering from burnout, and other people are suffering from rust out. So they're bored by what they're doing. There's not enough challenge. There's not enough growth opportunity, toxic work environments or a poor relationship with colleagues and bosses. And oftentimes the easy thing to say is, well, it's a salary issue because it masks the fact that these other things are actually at play. And the other thing that I'm noticing on the ground is that people are leaving where they're not getting access to flexibility. So where they're kind of this mandated return to office, you know, that's a real deal breaker for people, because during COVID and in the aftermath of COVID, people worked from home very effectively. Productivity wasn't impacted. And people have gotten used to it, not as a, you know, as a nice to have, as an almost as an essential. So people are using, they're voting with their feet, okay, when it comes to these three issues. Yes.
They say, Peter, the cliche goes that the best time to look for a job is when you're in a job. Except it's not, because looking for a job is an incredibly time consuming thing to do and rather hard to do if you're working 40 hours a week somewhere.
It is. And I, we always say to people that, you know, you have to treat it like a job, you know, put time in your diary, actually research and so forth. The only challenge to that is one of the biggest parts of getting a job now is networking, actually speaking to other people about jobs that you haven't heard about because you want people to recommend you. And that's a lot easier to do when you're in a job. I hate to say it, when you're out of a job and you try and get a coffee and meet somebody, it becomes a little bit trickier, okay, than when you're in a job.
Have you tips to do it without antagonizing your existing employers?
To looking for a new job. I mean, reality is you have a lot of time during the day that is your time. Use that time. A lot of people, you know, don't take their lunch break. They don't organize that. But the reality,
I know, but if somebody walks up behind you and they say curriculum vitae across the top of the, yeah, computer screen, they're not going to be impressed.
No, I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't be doing that. But there is a lot of things you can probably do in terms of connecting. And the first thing I always say to people before you're immediately looking to leave your job, there's often a lot of opportunities within your organization, but aren't maybe going up the ladder, but across the ladder to somewhere else. And that's actually by just kind of going down and, let's say you're in sales, meeting people in digital or marketing or other areas. People don't do that as much. And often when people leave their job, they realize, oh my God, there's lots of opportunities that I never even saw in my own organization.
Okay. Sinead, have you any tips in this regard for managing your time while job hunting?
Yeah, so again, I would agree with Peter in the sense that it's really important to have that time in your diary, because you, it could become something that kind of, it just takes over every hour of what you're doing and becomes all consuming. And then you end up not being that productive. So what I would say is, I always say to people, the first day that you start your job is the day that you should think about moving to the next job. And you should have an exit strategy in place from day one. And what I mean by that is that, you know, rather than panicking when it's time to move and trying to figure out, well, what did I do? Where were my contributions? That you actually keep a file on an ongoing basis, not on the work laptop or computer, but somewhere else, you know, your own private device, And in that, every week you just reflect on what you've done, what your contribution was, so that you're building up a profile of the work that you've done in the role that you're currently in. So when it comes to time to move, to resign, or if it's out of your control, if it's a redundancy situation, that actually you have already built up a bank of information about your contribution, about your skills, and about what you have done in the particular role. So doing the CV, kind of doing the application form and getting out there thinking about moving is not as hard as it might seem if you're starting with a blank page.
Okay, because it does mean, doesn't it, Peter, that when it comes to time to answer that really stupid question about what are the three most impressive things that you have done in your career to date, that you don't just end up rattling off the last three things you've done. You say, these are the three most impressive things I've done. But I notice that there are some employers who are giving people all the questions that they expect them to answer in an interview before going to interview now.
Yeah, it makes sense, because actually what you want is somebody to actually do a very good interview. And actually the one who does a good interview is the one who gives the best answers, but they are prepared and have evidence behind them. And actually, in a lot of ways, if you give people no answers and no questions, you can guess some of them. But the reality is people who are nervous cannot do as well as people who are maybe very good actors. So if you're very good at presenting yourself well, you'll come across really well in interviews. Interviews have been seen to be a very, very poor effective idea of whether you're going to be good in the job. It's much more about doing things like assessments. There's charities out there like Generation Ireland, which do boot camps, which gives you like a 12-week program and then puts you in a job. Let's not worry about what people did 20 years ago when they got their CV. Let's worry about in their career, or like whether they got a 2-1 or a 2-2. It's 20 years later. Let's see if they've got the skills today and, more importantly, want to do the job that you're putting them forward to.
And even more importantly than that, if they're interviewing for a writing job or a maths job, you're not really that worried about how good a communicator they are in interview, are you?
No, and that's the key. I mean, a lot of people go for coding jobs and, you know, they're saying, look, will you just give me some code and I'll show you how I can do it? Because that's really the most important thing. They're not going to be there every day in brainstorming meetings or meeting clients. That's the job. So the starting point is, what is the job we're going to do? So employers need to be thinking about the skills today, not worrying about what they did 20 years ago.
Sinead, is it just a few isolated enlightened companies that are doing that, or is that becoming more widespread, giving out the questions beforehand?
Yeah, so this was an initiative by in England this year, and it was very interesting. It's actually part of their diversity and inclusion strategy, so that people who are nervous in interview, or perhaps people that are neurodivergent, it is easier and it is fairer to give people the questions beforehand, so as Peter says, they can be prepared. So yes, there are some companies doing this, and then there are other companies that are using a range of different situational type texts and type assessments to help understand how good you actually are at the job, rather than how good you are at interview or performing an interview. So we are moving, the world of work and the world of interviews are moving alongside what the needs are, and we're beginning to think, well, you know, how do we assess who's going to be the best person in this job? And as you say, if we need somebody to write code, the best way to assess whether they're good at writing code or not is to have them write code. If we need somebody to be a people manager, then we have to really understand what their people skills are like, what their communication skills are like. And we need to think differently about recruiting for that than we do for a different type of role.
Can I just return, Sinead, to your point about having an exit strategy in place from the moment that you start in the job? Do you not think that bosses recognise that in employees, the person with their eye on the exit door?
So I actually know. So I would, you would, so within your exit strategy, what you will have is, this is how I intend to grow in this role. This is how I intend to progress in this role. So you have key markers in place for yourself in terms of doing and developing really well in the role. So what your employer will see is somebody who's very focused, who's very clear on what they want to achieve in the role, and who is doing that on an ongoing basis. So rather than waiting for the performance review or whatever, you have your own markers of success that are key and tied in with what the business needs are. So what your boss will see, or what your team around you will see, is somebody who's very clear, very focused, and doing a really good job. And I don't mean that at the end of the 18 months that you need to leave, or the end of the 2 years you need to leave. But certainly you should be looking up and looking around and asking, well, what is the next step? What's the next? And so exit doesn't always mean leaving. It could be that lateral move. It could be something, you know, education, or it might actually be a pause. So it is just about being in control and having ownership of your career. And from every single organization that I walk into, they want employees to have a sense of ownership over their career.
Peter, let's deal with the pause there. I'm burnt out or I've rusted out. I need to take 3 months, 6 months, maybe a year if I can afford it to go and find my mojo and recharge my batteries again. How do I explain that gap in the CV to my next employer?
I always say that a gap isn't an issue as long as you not just explain it well, but can almost say, look, you can speak to my manager, because what they really want to do is speak to someone else. They're not really going to believe you because they've probably heard everything, right? So this, you start by saying, I'd love you to speak to my manager and explain to him why I took the time off and why I'm now ready and supercharged and ready to go again. I think that's not as big an issue. The longer the gap becomes and the less ability you have to explain. The other thing they're going to want to know is if you're taking the year off, explain what you've done in the year. If you can only talk about watching every Netflix documentary, they're going to be a little worried. They'll want to know that you maybe were coaching aside or, you know, gardening or doing anything with your time. So they know you're actually still out and about. So I think it is important how you present that. And you have to practice that because you get one chance to say that and they're going to make their decision very quickly on you.
Sinead, Peter's being very glass half full about that. Do you think that when faced with one candidate with no gap in their CV versus somebody else who's taken 6 months to watch box sets, that the choice for any employer is obvious?
I think it depends on the employer and depends on what they value. And employers are increasingly looking at the skill. They're looking at, you know, what does this person add to the culture? Not do they fit in with the culture, but what do they add to the culture? What diversity of thought, what diversity of thinking, what diversity of ideas and creativity can they bring? And sometimes that break increases. I mean, research tells us when you take a break, and it might just be that your breaks are intermittent or in a bigger chunk, that actually your ability to engage, your ability to think, your ability to be creative increases, not decreases. So gaps, I think, by employers are going to be seen in a very, very different way across the course of time.
Increasingly, we are hearing that employers, Peter, are using AI, at least at the first round, to filter out candidates. That's really rather a dreadful vista, isn't it? Because AI is just going to look for more and more of the same kind of people.
Yes and no. The reality is for 25 years, we've been using technology to look at CVs. I mean, once the internet came about, instead of getting 30 CVs during the post, in 1 minute, you could get a million or a thousand CVs by people just clicking in every job ad, which people were doing. So suddenly companies had no way of going through them. So the first part was always some sort of machine learning tool to actually just take it from 5,000 to 50. And that was the case. They were getting huge. The difference with artificial intelligence, as you said, is our worry is we often don't know why they're picking the ones they're picking. And if they're always looking at the type of people they always had, they're always going to get the same people. So back to Sinead's point about diversity, we're going to get less of it. I would worry less about that. My worry is more when they start doing the interviewing, which is what they're happening now. And they're actually doing video interviews and looking at our facial cues and making judgments on those. And I'm sure they
will. Sorry, AI is doing this.
Absolutely. Unilever got their graduate program from 6 months to 4 weeks because they were doing video interviewing where the AI was actually looking at your face and they were making decisions on who would be put forward. Okay. There was still a person who did the final stages, but their point was they were trying to get from a huge amount of people to a very small amount. And that's the case of every sort of interview. There's always lots at the start.
So sorry, just explain to me, was the candidate actually being interviewed by ChatGPT and not by a real life human
I mean,
being?
When I say interview, I mean, here's the question and they answer the question. So it was very much just kind of, there's a question, not a back and forth. But they were looking at their facial cues to, and they were making decisions based on physiognomy or whatever they call that term. Where that's the way, which kind of worries me. But the point is, the companies often say it's really good because it's faster. I go, it is faster. That doesn't mean it's better because you have no idea about how upset or annoyed the people who don't get the job are, who may never want to work for your company again. So you've always got to be careful about speed and efficiency over long-term effects on your brand.
Sinead, have you any thoughts on that?
So I think AI is great, but what we need to do is we need to ask ourselves, when we free up all of this time, what are we going to do with it? And when it comes to interviewing, I know it's important that we free up time, but does that mean that we are developing echo chambers within our organisations as opposed to actually finding that culture add, where we are adding people to the culture of the organisation that have the capacity to stretch, to think, and to move the organisation along with the future? And I would suggest that where AI is interviewing, we have to be very, very careful around that, because not all facial expressions are equal. Not everybody will respond and their facial expression will map what they're thinking.
I can imagine that my facial expression, if I knew I was being interviewed by a computer, would be absolutely ghastly throughout. There's no way you could be sending positive signals or putting your best foot forward.
Absolutely. So we have to think, and we do know, as Peter said earlier, that interviews are that one of the least successful ways to recruit the right person. But also, if we are now bringing AI into that, we just have to be very careful about what type of workplace and what is the impact of this on the workplace of the future. And are the people that we want actually the right people, or are we testing this on a very small pilot and retaining, you know, more inclusive, diverse ways of including people as culture adds as opposed to culture fits?
Oh, stop the world, I want to get off. All right, Peter, thank you both very much. Fish deaths in the Ballysadare River after this.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.